And this is KPCW. Good morning. It's 8:06. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Parker Malatesta. It's currently 49 degrees and blue skies here in Old Town Park City, about 10 degrees warmer over in the Heber Valley. On the phone with me to talk more about weather, I've got meteorologist Nate Larson from ABC4. How's it going, Nate?
Good morning, Park City. Yeah, in Heber, we've got gorgeous weather shaping up for your Friday. Temperatures have cooled off a little bit after some of those showers and storms that rolled through yesterday. Sunshine will stick around throughout the entire day Friday up in Park City. Highs in the upper 70s. Heber looking at mid-80s for highs with sunshine as well. Gorgeous weekend. High pressure building in. Increasing southwest flow will crank up our temperatures heading into Saturday. So plan on mid-80s for Park City tomorrow. And on Sunday, we're tracking another weak front that's going to slide in and drop temperatures into early next week. So above average warmth ahead of that front. Sunday, we'll see clouds increase late Sunday with mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies on Monday. We'll drop to the low 80s. Overnight lows in the mid-50s in Park City. Continuing to fall into the upper 70s on Tuesday. A bit of a rebound with high pressure building back in quickly. So more summertime, typical summertime temperatures and conditions towards middle of next week with lots of sunshine. Heber looking at mid-90s over the weekend, dropping into the upper 80s and mid-80s into early next week following the weak front. Really no threat of moisture out there with this passing front Sunday into Monday. Might see mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies. Otherwise, with more sunshine taking over midweek, temperatures rebounding to near 90 degrees on Wednesday.
All right. Thanks, Nate. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend. You too. See ya.
Traffic is flowing smoothly in the Wasatch back this morning. Just seeing some slight delays on eastbound I-80 heading towards the Silver Creek Junction over there towards around US 40, the interchange there that kind of expected due to the construction of the roundabout there, right there in Silver Creek. Well, coming up, we'll have Park City Council member Bill Sirocco in studio. He'll have a recap of last night's City Council meeting, which included an update on Bonanza Park plans. Then the Salt Lake Tribune's Lauren Gustis, who was just named the publication's first joint CEO and executive editor, will join the show to detail this week's primary election. After that, stay tuned for Fresh Tracks Friday at 9. Each Friday, 12 new songs are added to our library and introduced at the top of every hour. This week, we have tracks from Mavis Staples, American Authors, and a whole lot more. Well, Vice President Kamala Harris will be in Utah today with a stop planned in Park City. KPCW's Matt Sampson has what people need to know.
President travels to and from Summit County. Harris is attending a fundraiser on behalf of President Joe Biden, who is running for re-election in November. Authorities remain tight-lipped about the afternoon event at a private home in the area. Summit County Sheriff Chief Deputy Casey Bates says the lack of public information is standard as a precaution for dignitary and state visits.
When the vice president comes or anybody of that nature, a lot of protections come into play. And with those protections come delays, and so we just ask that motorists be patient.
If the vice president's visit is anything like Biden's visit to Park City last year, residents can expect intermittent road closures and traffic delays before and after the event. It's unclear if Parley's Canyon will be temporarily closed for the vice presidential motorcade, but similar precautions were made during the president's visit in 2023. KPCW will have updates throughout Harris's visit Friday, including road closures and delays. Full details are available at kpcw.org. Matt Sampson, KPCW News.
So once again, expect some potential traffic delays. We'll keep you updated here on KPCW as we learn details of the vice president's visit, but could be potentially looking at some backups in Parley's Canyon. In other news, a private cowboy museum in Midway will open its doors for a free open house on Independence Day. KPCW's Amber Johnson has more on that.
Tom Whitaker's face lights up as he sits perched on Grandpa's body chair and describes the Wild West artifacts he has spent 51 years curating with his wife, Linda. The collection is housed in a 140-year-old cabin that looks straight out of a Western movie on the north side of Midway's Memorial Hill at 510 North River Road. It's only open one day a year, July 4th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and for the occasional private tour. Tom estimates he has 2,000 to 3,000 items in the 2,500-square-foot cabin. A photo of the original structure hangs on the wall near the entryway. He purchased some of the collection from Gary and Carol Russell from Camas, and the rest was found online and in antique stores. Tom's Cabin has a Buffalo Bill room, railroad memorabilia, cowboy and Indian artifacts, and the collection of Civil War era treasures. Each item is carefully staged on antique furniture or preserved in display cases. An old coin-operated horse sits dormant, waiting to come to life.
My wife likes these. She collected that.
What is that?
It's just the old 1950s grocery store, you know, put your money in and sit and shoot the Indians, which is not very politically correct, but buffalo comes and then Indians come and you can sit and shoot them.
Does it still work?
There's even a brothel upstairs with all the items you'd expect to find. Frilly corsets, ornate hair combs, garters, elegant hand fans, perfume bottles, and a small gun the women use to protect themselves. A basket of coins sits at the foot of the bed.
These are actually replicas, even though they don't look like replicas. But these are little tokens. Food, whiskey, and girls. Any way, any day. Anyway.
So these were just tokens they would use in the brothel? Or what?
Yeah, yes.
So how would that work? So
I'm not sure. I've never been to one.
Tom said his family moved to the Heber Valley from California in 1952, and he's always been fascinated by old things.
My dad and uncles bought Schneider's Hot Pots and turned it into the homestead. So it was a family-run business. And I remember going with my dad to Park City when it was only like 250 people. I mean, it was a ghost town, literally. And we were walking up and down Main Street looking for antiques. And I still have a gun that we bought on one of our visits. It's over at the house, 1860 Civil War musket.
He has a few personal artifacts, including an old pair of snowshoes his wife gifted him when they were first married, as well as a family photo.
This is actually my great-great-grandfather, George Whitaker, with his four sisters. I always thought they were his wives, but my mother said, no, those were all his sisters. They don't look very happy, do they?
But this private cowboy museum is sure to bring a smile to your face as you rediscover this forgotten slice of Americana on the nation's birthday. Amber Johnson, KPCW News.
And Wasatch County Council members approved a developer's application for two public infrastructure districts, or PIDs, Wednesday. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports on that.
Both developments are east of the Jordanelle Reservoir. One is for the Black Rock Mountain Resort, a primarily commercial project, and the other is for Wakara Ridge, a neighborhood under construction east of Toohey. PIDs are a way for developers to build infrastructure like roads and utilities using bonds. Those bonds are repaid through special assessments or property taxes, so property owners in the district could be charged extra to cover the cost. The debt only applies to properties within the PID, making it a financially attractive option for the county, but the district is independent of the government once approved, which limits local oversight. In the county council meeting June 26th, council members said many residents asked whether condo owners in the Black Rock development would be included in the PID. PIDs require 100% consent from all property owners in the proposed district. Russell Skousen, the developer's attorney, said the application specifically left out all units that weren't owned by the developer.
There is no property owner that is a third party owner that is included in any way in this petition for a PID. We just expressly exclude them.
A full list of units excluded from the district can be found on kpcw.org. The council pressed Skousen to define the public benefits the PID policy requires to justify the new public infrastructure districts. Skousen said infrastructure inherently benefits the public. He added the projects could bring significant tax revenue to the county.
We had an economic impact study on this, and the impact over the life of the bonds that would be involved here was, in excess of $700 million to the county, just in tax dollars.
Councilmember Eric Rowland questioned the Black Rock Event Center in particular, saying there should be a way to ensure county residents benefit from every project included in the PID application.
If you present it as an argument to make it as part of that public good, then we would certainly want to expect to see that as a policy on your side to make sure that it is accessible to the public. Otherwise, don't present it as a public good.
Skousen also argued approving PIDs benefits the county because it's competitive with MIDA, the Military Installation Development Authority. MIDA is a state agency originally founded to support the military, governed by a board that's appointed, not elected. It invests in economic development projects to generate revenue for its programs. MIDA is involved in several major developments in Wasatch County, like Deer Valley's East Village Resort expansion and the Sky Ridge Luxury Golf Course.
MIDA has many more tools to help developers than are found outside of MIDA. The county benefits more from this development than it would the MIDA development.
Despite the council's hesitations about the public benefits of the two projects, members unanimously approved both PID applications. The applications will now be sent to the county's bound council for further review before the PIDs are officially created. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
In studio with me now, I've got Park City Councilmember Bill Sirocco. How's it going, Bill?
It's going great, relatively speaking. I mean, I think last night was pretty interesting. After the council meeting, I got home and I made the mistake of turning on CNN. I'm here this morning. I'm ready to go, Parker.
Okay, good to know. Well, you're kind of in the middle of two meetings right now, but last night was all things Bonanza Park, so I figured we'd start with what was the council's first discussion, which was the small area plan, which looks at kind of the entire neighborhood is about 200 acres, I think.
Yep.
So it's kind of a high level document. Kind of as a council member, how do you view this plan and just what it shapes going forward?
So I think, we had a really, really engaging conversation last night with the consultants who have helped us with that. We also had our chair of the Planning Commission, Sarah Hall, was in the meeting with us, and Bill Johnson was on remotely just to give us some context from the Planning Commission point of view, because they did forward that with a positive recommendation, and there was a unanimous, Planning Commission vote on that. The thing that was difficult last night that really got teased out over the course of the process is that the small area plan is the plan. But the way the plan gets implemented happens through the land management code, and that's the next step, and that's a much more detailed step, and that'll really inform what we do in that area. And for the public, the way I would describe it is, it's as if the Congress passes a bill, say something to regulate banking, that bill then goes to the Treasury Department, and then it's up to the Treasury Department to actually write the law and figure out how to enforce. And that's a bit like the process we have now.
Yeah, so it's kind of setting up the stage for these more detailed code amendments. I wanted to mention, kind of the key recommendation out of this plan is kind of to zone Bonanza Park, this new mixed-use zone. And I think one of the interesting elements of that is kind of allowing for this density bonus that would allow developers to build up to, I believe, four stories if they're offering, this still needs to be ironed out, but kind of some defined community benefits, whether that's underground parking, affordable housing. How are you approaching that concept?
Yeah, that's one of those things where, people in the community, residents hear the words density, they hear, an additional story of height, and we judge those things in the abstract. We're not judging those looking at what is, best in class design and saying, okay, now I understand what that looks like. So I think the council really would like to lean into this process. We spent a significant amount of money on the consultants to help us through this. We spent a lot of time. We've had, stakeholder groups. We've had community engagement. And it feels like, with all that work, we really should lean into the process and be a little bit bold. And that means, that means looking at density. That means looking at height. And I would assure the public that nobody on council wants to change the feel of Park City. We're looking to make the place better. We're looking to make a new neighborhood that serves the local population in a way that hasn't been done before.
Yeah, and next I wanted to mention the frontage protection zone, and you could maybe explain this a little better than me, but it's kind of this setback that you notice if you're maybe driving on Park Ave or Kearns, especially around maybe the DoubleTree Hotel there on the corner, and you kind of have this 100-foot setback, and that's required to kind of maintain this rural resort character and just have that area cleared with landscaping, or I guess it's mostly parking now. So how is the city looking at potentially changing the zone and the regulations around that?
Yes, Parker, that's a great question. And one of the questions I asked last night was, if during the process of, you know, evaluating, you know, the small area plan in that corridor, the Kearns corridor, if we did the exercise, the thought exercise of, let's imagine we didn't have the frontage protection zone in place currently, but through this process, we said, yeah, we probably should have some sort of frontage protection zone. What would that look like today, right, given all this work that we're doing on planning for that area? Would it be different than what we did 20 years ago? Maybe because what we're planning for that area is different than, you know, what was 20 years ago. This small area plan, and with the 5-acre parcel that the city owns on the easternmost portion of that, will become, you know, it essentially will be the new doorstep into town. You'll arrive in a part of town that has, you know, much more commercial activity in terms of retail, hopefully restaurants, you know, that locals can enjoy. So I wanted to, you know, make sure we thought about that thoroughly. You know, that being said, the city owns the 5 acres on the corner of Kearns and Bonanza, and that frontage protection zone greatly impacts what we can do on that 5-acre lot. We've got, you know, I'm going to guess about 400 feet of frontage on Kearns Boulevard. And, you know, you can't do anything in the first 30 feet. And then from 30 to 100 feet right now, I believe the code as written limits you to 2 stories. You know, we wanted to just evaluate that and see if there's some flexibility there.
Yeah, and I, some of the concepts that were being presented last night, and once again, these aren't final, but I think I referred to it as kind of a wedding cake concept, where just as kind of what's being proposed right now, someone could kind of build out, and then as it goes farther away from the road, it could get higher up.
Yeah, no, that's how it was described. And as we were in the meeting, as we were talking about that, you know, there were some... Yeah, the conversation was, look, Kearns Boulevard, it's you know, 4 lanes wide with a turning lane, and there's, you know, traffic on there, and that's different than, you know, other places around the country, you know, that might have a little bit closer or, you know, smaller setback. And so as the meeting was going on, I'm on Google Maps, and I'm, like, you know, plugging in places around the country, and one of the places I plugged in was Aspen, Colorado, and Aspen, Colorado, Colorado State Highway 82, basically dead ends in Aspen. It's a dead end canyon, and it's 5 lanes plus parking right into Main. Like, it becomes Main Street essentially in town, and it's pretty analogous. And if you look at that streetscape, it's tremendously inviting, and it looks really awesome. And I'm hoping that, you know, we look outside of the, you know, our community, and we see other communities that have done things and maybe incorporate some of those best practices.
Yeah, and, you know, at the end of the day, these are kind of, you know, what these codes or rules are in place to kind of allow a developer that wants to redevelop a project, kind of help the city meet its goals of making this area more connected. But we can kind of turn to the maybe the more fun discussion, because this is where the city really controls what happens on these 5 acres at the corner of Bonanza and Kearns. Last night was kind of a wide discussion, but a lot of financials, and I sensed in the room a pleasant surprise with the numbers, if not disbelief, at what the figures were coming out, kind of calculating all that we had. What were you thinking?
Yeah, so I didn't address part of your earlier, prior question, Parker. Yeah. So community benefit, you know, we're thinking about things like, you know, what sort of workforce housing mix we can get in there. That drives some of the community benefit. We're thinking of public amenities, you know, and the term open space gets thrown around a lot. I don't think that's the right term for that area. We're talking public spaces, you know, plazas, you know, wide esplanades, walkways, you know, that are fronted with some retail, coffee shop. You know, you go in, you grab a cup of coffee, you come outside, you sit on a bench that's a tree planter, you know, just a place for the community to gather. And then, you know, transit stops are in the mix of, you know, public benefit. And I think we had a list, and it's not totally It doesn't include everything, but I think that we had like 9 or 12 options that would, you know, provide some sort of public benefit. And the trade-off is the more public benefit a developer brings to the table, the more flexibility the Planning Commission and the council will have with what happens there. It still will have to fall within the bounds of the code, but we're looking to make sure that we have the flexibility so that we do this right, we get it right. This is a generational opportunity. On the financials last night, the biggest surprise, as you noted, was around the potential for LIHTC housing to be a financing tool for some of the more affordable workforce housing that we're looking to implement. And the trade-off is, were we to pursue that, we'd need to build some flexibility into the timeline, the project schedule, in terms of phasing. And there seemed to be some support on the council to do phasing, because if we're able to secure LIHTC financing, the cost of the community, through City Hall, like what we would put into the project, goes down dramatically. So I think that's something that we're going to, be talking about a lot more.
And it seemed that the consultant said that phasing the project wouldn't necessarily turn off a developer.
No, look, it's a 5.43 acre site. So it's a big, developing on that site will be a big project. And if you think about that area, everything around it is still going to continue to operate. And there isn't really any space around for lay down, for storage of materials, for staging, for construction. So the ability to phase actually would actually help a developer greatly, because they can use part of the site for their staging for each phase of the project. And, people say, oh, well, isn't the construction going to cost more? That comes from two things. It comes from inflation. But the benefit of that situation is you also get inflation in terms of rents that are received. So that economic part of it kind of balances out. And then the other one is just from, economies of scale. Like you would think if I build a small project, it's going to cost me more on a per square foot basis than a bigger project. And that essentially is true. But those economies of scale go away pretty quickly once you start getting up into, 10,000, 20,000 square feet. After that, there's really not much left to squeeze out of the lemon.
Yeah, and I just want to kind of mention some of the other financial variables the consultants discussed last night. One was transient room tax bonding capacity, and the other one was the city potentially maybe selling a portion of that land, which I'm sure has risen in value since it was purchased in 2017, I believe.
No, absolutely, yeah. Anyone that owns real estate here in town knows that from 2019 to 2022, most everything pretty much doubled in value. So that land that we own is worth significantly more than we paid for it, which is great for us. But we want to make sure what happens there benefits the community and creates a place in town for locals to congregate, for local businesses to establish themselves, new restaurants to innovate and experiment and, provide, great experiences for people here. I think the... I think the city council is committed to getting this right. But I think more importantly, we want to see something happen. It's been a long time. The city's owned that property since 2017. It's time to get moving.
Yeah, and I know things aren't finalized yet, but just to kind of give people a picture of kind of where the council is beginning to settle, I think I'm hearing housing. Obviously, last night, I think there was really a push for more retail space, maker space. We've already talked about having a new headquarters for the Kimball Arts Center there. Where do you feel like the council is kind of settling on what exactly to do here?
Yeah, I think initially the conversation last night surprised us because the scenarios that they had laid out, those weren't recommendations. They were just meant to kind of show us how the economics moved depending on what the complexion of the project was. But fortunately, the A few of those examples had a very small amount of retail space, and that actually awakened us to make sure we focused on bringing to that project what the community asked for, and the community asked for, sort of a in-town, almost think of it like a town square, you know, where there are shops and stores that are oriented to the local population, not to the tourists, to the guest visitors, which Main Street does an amazing job of that. We have an amazing Main Street, Old Town, serves that purpose fantastically. And what happens over in that Bonanza Park area will not take away from Main Street in any way, shape, or form. I argue that whatever happens over there will be additive to what happens to Main Street. It'll bring people that live in Park City into the in-town area and provide, you know, probably more opportunities for locals to actually run over to Main Street because they're close by. So we're really excited. We're really, really excited, and we're hopeful that this can be a game changer for the community.
Yeah, and forgot to mention underground parking too. The council seemed very supportive of putting a garage there.
Yeah, as you come into town on Park Avenue and you pass Kearns Boulevard, you see in front of the Fresh Market, you see a sea of parking. You see in front of the Walgreens a sea of parking. That's not really the entry to town that I think speaks to Park City and the community that we have. So we're hopeful that the small area plan is a catalyst for redevelopment in that area, so that appearance can change over time. A big part of that's putting the parking underground, and you know, given, and that's very expensive. I mean, extremely expensive, somewhere in the order of $60,000 per spot. But one of the interesting items that came out of the discussion last night was the consultants used an estimate of, I think, $65,000 to put an underground parking spot and $45,000 for an at-grade parking spot. So the question I asked was, does that $45,000 include the land value for that parking spot? And they said no. So the difference between the two is actually less than $20,000, because you'd have to add in some land value for that 200 square feet that the parking spot sits on, and that valuation it makes the math pretty compelling to put the parking underground, which I think serves the community better. It gives us more space on top to work with, more areas for bike paths, for walkways. And it really provides a more pedestrian experience through that district. So we're hopeful that not only on our parcel, but whatever additional redevelopment happens in that area incorporates that as well.
Yeah. Going back to low-income housing tax credits, you and I took a tour of the Engine House affordable housing site on Wednesday. What'd you make of the progress?
It's pretty amazing. I mean, if you read the stories or you followed the progress of the Engine House through the Planning Commission and City Council, you know, the number was 123 or 124 units, 99 of which are, affordable housing, average AMI, somewhere between 60 and 80%. I can't remember the exact number, but, you think 123 units, it's not that much. That is a big project, mm-hmm. and that's only a 1.8 acre site.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
So to be able to get that number of units on that lot is pretty amazing, and it speaks to the potential for that whole area. I think we could see a very large impact into our workforce need happening in that area. And that would be great for the city.
Yeah, the progress. Over on Homestake Road, check it out. It's noticeable. Well, moving on, the council will meet again. I believe it's at 10 a.m. today. One of the first items on that agenda is a new e-bike ordinance, but I believe that would kind of just add a single trail connecting over towards Clark Ranch, kind of more Wasatch County area, which I know has a lot more e-mountain bike friendly trails.
Yeah, Parker, that's exactly correct. And it's quite ironic. You think about all the work we're doing with the small area plan in Bonanza Park, we think about some of the other issues in town, the pressing need for more workforce housing, the pressing need for childcare, the amount of public input on and the amount of communication from the public to council council email has been staggering.
It makes you
really understand that a lot of our problems here in Park City are first class problems, but in part of that process and that robust public dialogue, sometimes the facts get lost a little bit. So I want to make sure that the community understands council is not really looking to change our policy right now on e-bikes, and we're talking about specifically e-mountain bikes.
Right. Single track.
Correct. Single track, soft surface biking trails. What council has decided to do is to provide one access point from Park City over, and that would originate in the snow park area, over Deer Crest into the new East Village area of Deer Valley, which is going to have, when they're finished, 50 miles of single track e-mountain bike accessible trails.
Yeah.
We'd like to have folks that are in Old Town, in the core town here, be able to access those trails, that are essentially 2 or 3 miles away, rather than sending them on a circuitous route out down the rail trail, through Clark Ranch, down along 40, and then back under 40 and over to the new East Village, which is probably it might be an 11 or 12 mile bike ride. And by the way, we did adopt one new policy for e-bikes, and that's on the paved trails. We did adopt a 15 mile an hour speed limit. So that means you're going to be on the rail trail for about 4 miles and you can't go over 15 miles an hour. So it'll make that trip longer. So we wanted to have a better connection from in town. That's not a change in policy. It's not even really a pilot. This is just providing that one connection. I want the community to understand that I can only speak for myself. I'm committed to us continuing to have a world-class trail system here in Park City. We need to expand that to some degree in terms of some additional trails. And then we need to think about some segregation of uses on trails. So perhaps a hiking-only trail, perhaps a regular mountain biking trail only, perhaps some e-mountain biking trail only, and then also some directional trails, uphill only and downhill only. Now, we can't do that. We can't snap our fingers and make that happen overnight. That's going to be a process over the next several years. But I'm committed to the city putting resources in to making sure that we continue to have one of the best trail networks, not just in the country, but the world.
Yeah, and I did want to mention, I believe the meeting was delayed, but I believe Bays and Rec was looking at instituting the 15 mile per hour speed limit and an exception for 65 and older to use the e-mountain bike, which would reflect Park City's existing policy for single track.
Correct. Yeah, and that's been publicly spoken about by Basin Rex, because I don't want to speak for them at all. And I think the idea there was to kind of bring their trail regulation kind of in line with where Park City was, mm-hmm. Because our trails are connected. So that makes sense. I do know, and having spoken to some folks over at Basin Rec and a board member or two, they are understanding that e-mountain bikes are coming and that we're going to need to provide for that. And look, for a community and a city that prides itself on being open and inclusive, anything that we could do to get more, to get people out in the outdoors, is a benefit to the community. You spend some time outside, you tend to be happier, life seems to be a little bit better, and you stay a little bit more healthy. So that's really what this is all about.
Yeah, and then moving on, also on today's agenda, you guys are looking at approving a contract to start a new transit study on State Route 248. I know this topic you're very passionate about. What are you looking for in this?
Yeah, no, I guess I could say it's deja vu all over again. I think in 2009 we embarked on a similar study, which resulted in an answer. The answer that came back was, oh, we need to widen the corridor. We need to cut off part of PC Hill. We need to add more lanes so we can have more traffic come into town, which you know, thank God the community flinched at that point and said, you know what, we're not really interested in that. So I think this current study that we kick off is going to end up focusing on that corridor and trying to help us understand what we can do in terms of actually not bringing more cars in, but facilitating, you know, the people that need to come in, the workforce, the visitors, and doing that in an efficient and convenient way that we can incentivize people. And I think that'll dovetail nicely with a recent study, which is about to wrap up, on regional parking needs. Yeah. You know, look, not to take away any from any of the work that was done on that, but you know, I think if you say we want to have some regional parking, I mean, I think it's fairly clear that the options are the Kimmel Junction entryway and the Quinns Junction entryway. So I'm hopeful that all this work leads us to some answers that really address those corridors.
Yeah, and then finally, council is expected to get a presentation from Rocky Mountain Power about undergrounding some transmission lines in the area. I'm not sure exactly how this relates to the potential relocation of that substation, but kind of going back to Bonanza Park, you know, I know the council has expressed interest in trying to relocate that. What do you think that would open up the possibility to if that's able to be done?
No. Look, I mean, and that all falls into a few things in that area. So look, the city owns the 5.43 acres. The substation in that area, which is almost adjacent to our property, is about 0.8 of an acre. Adjacent to the substation is the where Recycle Utah is located. That's another half an acre. Mm-hmm. So there is the potential, if we can find a new home for Recycle Utah, which I'm extremely motivated to do. I'm the council liaison of Recycle Utah. I love what they do for the community. I'm a big supporter. I think it's an important part of reminding us on a daily basis of, you know, how we need to make sure we live a little bit better, be a little, you know, more considerate of the things we use and how we consume. So I'm committed to doing that. That'll free up a half acre of land that we can plan on. And then if we can get to consensus on council to make the investment to move the substation out of that area, it gives us another 0.8 of an acre. What we currently are doing now is you'll notice those power lines coming from the north side of Kearns Boulevard over the far eastern end of the cemetery into that district. We are looking to move forward, hopefully, on burying those lines through the 5.4 acre site that the city owns. Mm-hmm. Currently, with those lines overhead, that takes 60 feet away from us in terms of what we can. There's a 60 foot easement mm-hmm. that we can't infringe upon with any development on the surface where those power lines are. So from an economic standpoint, it's a pretty compelling investment to get those power lines out of that way. They would be buried under woodbine, so we would free up that entire parcel then to have a much broader palette of what we could do. Part of that undergrounding is we're gonna put the conduit in, so that if we do relocate the substation, that work's already done, and we don't have to mm-hmm. open up and cut the roads again.
Yeah. All right. Well, finally, Bill, I know you just had some news to share about those brand new Fresh Market bus stops.
Yeah, so pretty exciting, and shout out to our comms lead, Linda Jaeger. She reminded me last night, Tuesday, July 9th, 4 p.m., we are doing a ribbon cutting in celebration of the new Fresh Market bus stop on Park Avenue. The city had received grant money from the federal government, so we're in the process of renovating all of our bus stops, or most of our bus stops around town. And this Fresh Market one is the first one that we've done, and it looks fantastic. I know everyone's seen that construction. You know, the winter took a toll on the schedule for that, but it's done now. It's operating. It looks great. And I encourage everyone to come out on Tuesday, July 9th at 4 p.m.
They have ski racks. They're really nice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, look, we're a ski town. Like, we should have ski racks just about everywhere. I mean, we should have ski racks. They should be almost as ubiquitous as bike racks are in town.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else you wanted to mention, Bill?
Yeah, I'll just say, look, the bus stop project's great. We've done a lot of work there. We weren't able to incorporate any maker spaces in the bus stops, but the bus stops are pretty amazing. You know, I've biked by it like about five times now in the last week. So yeah, we're just really proud as a community that we can invest in the community. We can continue to make improvements. And you know, I think the council is pretty pretty excited about the potential that the Bonanza Park District holds. And that's it.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in and keeping us posted. We'll see you around.
Thanks, Parker.
We've been speaking with Park City Councilmember Bill Sirocco. I'll be right back to talk with Salt Lake Tribune Executive Editor Lauren Gustis. On the phone with me now, I've got Lauren Gustis, the Executive Editor and CEO of the Salt Lake Tribune. How's it going, Lauren?
I'm doing well. How are you, Parker?
Good. I figured we would hit on a lot of the busy election stuff this week. To start, I just figured we would hit on the governor's race. You know, Spencer Cox, I think, maintains about a 10% lead. But I guess the story now is more so becoming his opponent, Phil Lyman, is kind of casting some doubt on the results.
He is. So Spencer Cox won almost every county in Utah, almost all 29 of the counties that voted in the election. Phil Lyman won his own home county, right, which comes as no surprise. And following the election, the night of the election, you know, Phil Lyman started to chatter about whether the election results should be recognized. The next morning, he posted a 30-minute video on YouTube, went down that road even farther. You know, he says, you know, the race is getting closer. The only thing we know for sure in Utah is that we're being lied to. You know, there's a lot of pressure on folks to ensure that Spencer Cox wins and so on and so forth. Called Spencer Cox Gavin Newsom 2.0. Gavin Newsom is the governor of California, Democratic governor of California, I should say. So Lyman's, you know, trying to cast doubt, but everyone that we have spoken to and we have done due diligence has indicated that the results are legitimate and they are certified and that there is no path for Lyman to effectively challenge the results of the primary. And so that's where we're at. I don't know how long, you know, the chatter will quote unquote continue. We've got about a week until results are fully certified, right? So until results are final.
Yeah. And then kind of the other major race, the Republican primary for Mitt Romney's current Senate seat. John Curtis took that victory over Trent Staggs, who I believe had been endorsed by Trump and Senator Mike Lee. What do you think that result shows us about what Utah Republicans are thinking and feeling?
Yeah, that's a great question. We actually talked to Spencer Cox about this on Tuesday night after the initial results were dropped. And we started to see that not just John Curtis, but candidates in statewide races up and down the ballot won in the primary but did not win in the caucus, right? And so there's multiple paths to get on the ballot. One is the caucus route, one is the signature going route. And the signature going route candidates, for the most part, say for Mike Kennedy, won in their, you know, statewide elections. And they've obviously still got November and, you know, nothing is a done deal. But I think, you know, what Cox told us is, you know, the process is not representative. He said, sadly, for the last few years, it's become less and less so. It's supposed to represent the Republican Party. There's a disconnect there for sure. And so I think, you know, if you ask just any regular voter if they felt a disconnect between who the Republicans through the caucus are sending to the ballot and who they would prefer to vote for, it manifested itself in many of the results up and down, like I said, the primary ballot this past week.
Yeah, and then Celeste Malloy, the current House Rep Republican in the 2nd District, I saw as of yesterday, her lead has shrunk to less than 1,000 votes. Where do we stand? Could that race flip?
The race is still too close to call, and it is shrinking. So it was, you know, large when, you know, we looked at that final batch that was released on Tuesday night, got a little smaller on Wednesday, got a little smaller again. And it's really not for me to say. I'm not an expert here in terms of, you know, calling a racist coast. I will say, if you remember, Malloy, when she ran in the open race last year, was behind and then came from behind to win, right? And so could the same thing happen to her here with her challenger, Colby Jenkins, who received Lee's endorsement? I don't know, but we don't have long to wait. The election results should be certified by Wednesday next, so we'll know then.
Yeah. Any other specific Tribune coverage of the primary election you wanted to highlight?
You know, thanks. I would just say, you know, we've got some interesting maps that look at how Utahns voted. I think that as we look ahead, we're really focused on how we can get as much of our election-related reporting in front of as many people as possible. The Tribune's a subscription site, but all of our election-related reporting is free. And it's also available to partners like KPCW to pick up. So stay with us. We'll be here through November.
Yeah, and then Lauren, I did finally just want to touch on, I understand the Trib kind of recently went through a reshuffling of certain high-level staff. Could you kind of speak to the new position that people have been placed in? I know you kind of have a new role as well.
Yeah, I'm serving as CEO and executive editor. That's what do you want to call it? Is it a title? I guess it's a title. It's,
yeah.
Bestowed by the board, the Tribune's board. We're a nonprofit. You know, as we look ahead at how we will be sustainable in the years to come, we need to make sure that we remain relevant, and we need to manage some fairly complex lines of business, from subscriptions to advertising to obviously the philanthropic support that we get. And so the board has decided that it needs one leader. It needs one individual who can do that work and make that happen. Previously, you know, whereas there was a dual reporting structure into the board, that's no longer the case. And we have really strong leadership, both on the editorial side and on the advertising side, as well as in the philanthropic space moving forward. I'm very confident in where we're headed. I think this is a good move for us, and I'm looking forward to seeing where the Tribune goes in the year to come.
Yeah. Well, anything else you want to mention, Lauren?
Yeah, I would say, you know, we had some really interesting reporting on where houses are being built in Utah over the last year. And it's relevant to your listeners in that the majority of the new homes that are being built, per our reporter, Megan Banta, are in Wasatch and Rich counties. The interesting thing, and this may come as no surprise to your listeners, was the price of those homes and who may be occupying them. So while we're getting more homes, 8.5% and 6.1% in Rich and Wasatch counties, respectively, we are not necessarily getting that many more residents, right? So are they second homes? You know, are people living in them full time? And how does that help ease Utah's housing shortage? So it's a great story. Megan Banta took a crack at it. She's our data reporter. Encourage folks to take a look.
Yeah, is there a specific area of Rich County where there? I just had to look that up where that is. That's on the northeast kind of portion of the state over Bear Lake. Is there a specific city there that's seeing a lot of growth?
You know, I don't know that we had that data. We did dive into where the growth is along the Wasatch Back, but a little harder for us to pinpoint up in Rich County. I do think, like you said, Bear Lake, and if you look at where the housing growth is, it may be that those are second homes, right? And the number of homes is just not commensurate with the population growth that you would expect to see with those homes being built.
Yeah, well, all right. Well, thanks for joining us today, Lauren. For more Trib coverage, you can always visit sltrib.com. And as she mentioned, their election coverage is free. Have a good weekend, Lauren.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. Reminder again that Vice President Kamala Harris is expected in Park City for a fundraiser today. Motorists can expect traffic delays while the Vice President travels to and from Summit County. We're still awaiting to get details. Authorities remain tight-lipped about the afternoon event at a private home. Summit County Sheriff Chief Deputy Casey Bates says the lack of public information is standard as a precaution for dignitary and state visits. It's unclear if Parley's Canyon will be temporarily closed for the vice presidential motorcade, but similar precautions were made when President Joe Biden visited in 2023. In other news, Park City's Engine House affordable housing project is on track to welcome new residents next year. Nearly 40,000 tons of dirt have been moved since the Engine House project broke ground last year. Longtime local developer Rory Murphy, who is partnering with the city on Engine House, praised the progress so far during a site tour on Wednesday.
You're seeing 8 months of progress here. 8 months from now, you're going to see a heck of a lot more. You'll see all this framing in. You know, the drywall will be, you know, way far along, if not done. And it's just, it'll really start to shape up.
Crews have dug up the area for the underground parking garage, which will have a single spot for each unit. Murphy said they want to lessen the traffic impact of the project by encouraging residents to walk, bike, or take public transit. Engine House, located on Homestake Road near the Kimball Art Center and Boneyard Saloon, marks a significant shift in affordable housing strategy for Park City. After years of trying to be its own developer, the city is partnering with a private company and leasing the land at a rate of $1 for 99 years. The city is also waiving building fees in exchange for the affordable housing. Developer Jay Fisher is leveraging federal money by way of low-income housing tax credits to make the project financially viable. 99 of the 123 units at Engine House will be deed-restricted affordable across a range of incomes. The remaining 24 units will be market rate, providing more financial benefit to the developer. Murphy emphasized Wednesday that the square footage and amenities in affordable and market rate units will be the same as required under federal funding rules.
Like, someone can't walk up to this building and go, that's a market unit, that's a affordable unit. Obviously, some of these units are going to have spectacular views of Iron Mountain, of the ski resort. Like, we can't put all the market units with the beautiful views. It has to be interspersed.
Murphy said they're on track to cut the ribbon at Engine House next summer. Housing applications are expected to open in the spring. Thanks for listening to the Local News Hour.